This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us on our virtual Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. It is the election season. We're well into it, and of course, all eyes have been on North Dakota recently because of a very prominent Senate race. That is Heidi Heitkamp, the Democrat incumbent, being challenged by Kevin Cramer, the Republican, who wants to move from the House to the Senate. And we have with us today in studio Don Gagne. He's the NPR national political correspondent who's covering this important race, the Kavanaugh nomination business that's going on in Washington. Ashley Thornburg and I have got him here to talk about the business of covering the news. Thanks for being with us, Don.
It's a pleasure being here. My travels take me all over the place. I was just recently in Cleveland, and then I was in Elkhart, and then I was somewhere else. But I hadn't been to Fargo in a while, but this race is, as you know, just from watching television and everything else, I mean, the whole world is watching, as they say, so I'm glad I could get up here.
Well, Don, we got an email in our inboxes from Senator Heitkamp announcing that she was going to be voting no on Kavanaugh, and then maybe 5 minutes later we got an email saying Don Gagne is going to be in town. So I'm just wondering, were you planning this anyway, and the emails were just coincidental, or did you come here because of the no vote specifically?
No, I was on the ground already, and my email notifying you guys of my arrival somehow got caught in the buffer. I will tell you, I hit send on it while I was riding on the D.C. Metro a full 24 hours earlier, and it was kind of in the ether. But so I came thinking that I would straddle the vote. I'd be here for a day or two talking to voters, kind of seeing where people are on Heitkamp and her decision. Then the vote would come, which we all assumed is when we would find out what she was going to do. And then I was going to stick around for a day or two after that as she came back to the state and campaigned a bit or went to the debate or whatever it was. So I'd get kind of before and after reaction. What I did not expect, I was standing at the Democratic Party headquarters in downtown Fargo on Broadway there, when watching them work the phones and interviewing some volunteers, when word spread throughout the office there that she had announced she was voting no on Kavanaugh. And one of the volunteers I was talking to, it was while I was interviewing her, she got the word, and she started to get emotional.
It's an emotional issue with lots of constituents these days.
So I could feel it in that moment, and I felt like, oh, this looks like, in all my wisdom, I planned this just right. But I guess you make your own luck, right? And I certainly had some yesterday by being in that room at that moment.
Well, you said you've been in lots of places, and you're coming back to Fargo. When you fly into a state which, you know, has a very prominent race, how do you get the lay of the land? How do you kind of position yourself to cover it in a way that will work outside of North Dakota but also work inside North Dakota?
My goal, even though I'm, I am coming from Washington, and I'm dropping into places, and I generally have a pretty quick turnaround on at least the first story that I get in the air, get on the air from any given place. But my goal is to try to get a feel for the place as quickly as possible. Now, in this case, I had a day's notice before I came. But we've all been watching this race, so it's not like it's completely out of the blue. But I don't have a ton of contacts in North Dakota and in Fargo. You're not one of those traditional battleground states where I know I'm just going to be there, you know, 8-9 in the case of Ohio or Pennsylvania, 15 times a year.
Well, we've gone from flyover to fly into state.
Yes, mm-hmm. Exactly. So, I'll just tell you what I did this time. We made some calls out to party leaders just to let them know we were coming and to see if they had any events going on. That's how we found out about the phone banking that was going on, you know, downtown at that on behalf of the Democratic candidates yesterday. We take a look at the map, and we're always looking for a county that, say, went for Heitkamp 6 years ago and then went for Trump. Mm-hmm. Now, as it turned out, that was pretty easy, because just about every county that she carried 6 years ago went for Trump.
This was one of the reddest states he had.
Exactly. So you that always is kind of fertile ground. And, you know, and I got here and you do a lot of walking up to people on the street, asking how much they're paying attention, going to the diner, going to a coffee shop. But I did the other thing yesterday that I shouldn't give away all my secrets and all my tricks. But my favorite people in the whole world are the local county librarians. I walk in and first off, they know everybody.
They're well read.
They're well read, and they know what's going on, but they always point me to their periodical reading room. And your downtown Fargo library here has a great one, and it's got every edition, starting with today's and going back a week or two, of every single newspaper, large and small, in North Dakota. And a lot of Minnesota papers, too, which didn't do me a lot of good for this. And every paper in their life section or local section has that community calendar. So I mine those community calendars. And, I mean, you can certainly get good tape and good opinions walking up to people randomly if you pick your spots well. But it's always nice if you can find some event that serves as a magnet that brings the people to you. So maybe it's a parade. If it's a parade, I hear there's the UFTA parade this weekend somewhere, and I forget what town it's in. Forgive me, but it's like an hour plus southwest of here.
Well, there are all kinds of fall festivals. There's a Wishick has Sauerkraut Day. We're going there next Wednesday.
So you go there, and you have I mean this only in the best sense, a captive audience. There are people who can't say to you, no, I can't talk, I'm in a hurry, because they've set up their chair along the parade route an hour and a half or 2 hours early, and they have nothing to do but sit there. And if you walk up to them and start asking them questions, they're generally happy to talk and have you help them kill a little time. So I kind of do those sorts of things, and the library is often the first place where I get those clues to let me start pulling threads.
Well, Don, you should know that UFTA Day is in Rutland.
Great. So I'm from Michigan and spent most of my life in Michigan before I moved to Washington for work. But because of Michigan's Upper Peninsula, I know all about UFTA days and Budafisk and whitefish festivals and all that stuff.
So there was a Scandinavian immigration all around the northern
exactly.
tier here. Don, you covered the White House mm-hmm. for several years for NPR.
A decade.
Yeah.
Yikes.
What do you make of the White House press briefing these days? I mean, what do you hear from your colleagues?
So I've not covered the Trump White House full time during the entire Trump presidency, during the campaign, during the last 6 years of Obama. I was the guy who was wandering the country and coming to places, you know, just like this. But I did cover all of George W. Bush, all 8 years, and I did cover the first 2 years of Barack Obama. And people would say to me, wow, that must have been so different going from Bush to Obama. And certainly Bush and Obama are different personalities, different characters, different people. But the thing that struck me was how much the job was the same. Kind of the professional class at the White House, the staffers, the routines of just making that building work, and the kind of relationship that reporters have with an administration that, frankly, in both of those cases, didn't want to tell you everything just because they don't. Mm-hmm. That's just the nature of it, right? And it's like that at City Hall here and everyone else you've covered on a governmental level. But the thing that struck me was how similar it was going from Bush to Obama. What I hear from colleagues at NPR and just a lot of friends who are still in the White House press corps is how different this one is.
There are even fewer briefings these days.
There are fewer briefings that we used to start every day with an on the record but off camera briefing called the gaggle. And in the early days, it was just in the press secretary's office, and it was just kind of a casual exchange and a way to get some early comments on stuff that broke overnight and get a sense of what the day will hold. You don't have moments like that anymore. You have the president tweeting directly. You have the president calling out his own people, his own administration via Twitter and other means. It's very much a reflection of Donald Trump, how the press office is organized, how the entire White House is organized. So if their goal was to kind of tip over the apple cart and disrupt the institution and even, you know, blow certain things up, they've certainly done that and proudly done that. But that makes it a very different place to cover. And I probably can't say a lot more than that because I'm just not there. Mm-hmm. But I can tell you that I feel like my job out in the world has changed a bit as well. I mean, you do find more wariness of the press. You do find more reluctance to talk to us. It's always been about earning people's trust and then treating them, you know, fairly and accurately on the air.
So you're running into people who are accusing you of creating fake news?
You get some of that, but it's more just a reluctance mm-hmm. to, you know, kind of talk to this guy with a microphone who has come up to them either at the rally or at the diner.
Because he might manipulate what I said? Or
they just – they're they don't always express it. They don't always express it. But – so you just have to you know, you be persistent and, you know, if anybody kind of complains directly to me about, you know, about NPR being this or NPR being that, I always engage them. Mm-hmm. And I always try to leave them with a better impression of what we are, what NPR is, what journalists are, and what we do just by virtue of their having had this conversation with me.
You've mentioned a couple of times that you travel around the country covering politics. What's your impression of North Dakota and how do you feel like it's kind of comparing to different other pockets, obviously broadly, generally speaking?
You know, the thing I learn is every place is very much its own place. Now, I don't want to like leap to any sweeping, you know, conclusions here because I haven't been here, you know, for more than a few days on this particular trip. And prior to that, my trips here had tended to be in and out on a campaign plane with either Obama or Bush, or in and out, you know, like into the Fargo Dome for a presidential speech or something like that. And then you're out right afterward. The last time I was here for any length of time, I want to say it was 1996, I covered Red River flooding. Was that the year?
1997.
96 was the winter. 97 was the flood.
So 97. Yep. So I, you know, I came into Fargo and I kind of followed the crest up to Grand Forks, and I was in Grand Forks when they had that just horrific week of the flood and the fire. And I spent a long time kind of in the community and talking to people there. And my lasting impressions of this place are rooted in my very positive experience that week. And I say positive in that you're covering a horrific story where people's lives are just turned upside down and maybe they've lost their homes or at the very least their basements flooded. And, you know, I had people welcoming me still into their homes. I had people giving me homemade cookies that that their grandparents or their parents brought from, you know, Detroit Lakes or something. And, you know, I mean, this one guy delivered me a box of cookies, and he said, look, he said, we're going through it here. He says, but so are you. You're away from your family. And my mom, you know, I told my mom I'd talk to you, and she said maybe you'd like these cookies. And it's like, where does that happen? That doesn't happen anywhere, but it happened here. So that's kind of my lasting impression of it. You know, we spend a lot of time in Iowa, obviously, because of the caucuses. And, you know, our goal is always to try to see a place with eyes beyond, you know, the visiting journalist's eyes. There are a group of us from NPR who every year join that big annual bike ride across Iowa. you know, the rag ride, bike ride. And it's, you know, it's a 400 or 500 mile ride over a week, and we're on our bicycle seats and we don't talk politics, and there's 10,000 people making that ride. And I think we learn a lot more about Iowa in that week than we ever learn sitting in a campaign bus or even driving around in our rental car.
Well, speaking of that, though, I mean, you've been in this business for quite a long time.
Yeah.
And as a national political correspondent, how have you seen the way that politics is conducted in this country change, and how have you seen voters react to that?
So the biggest change has been, you know, the rise of social media and people's ability to get news from sources that only reinforce maybe their political beliefs, people sharing things. People
that may or may not be true.
Exactly. And one thing that when I talk to people, I find that they often have the quote-unquote talking points at the ready. So you might talk to 8 people at a rally and you – it's not verbatim, but you can get almost the exact same thing, you know, on question after question. So the goal is to engage them further, talk with them a little bit longer, have the conversation go other places, and kind of break through that practiced, you know, if somebody asks me a question, here's what I'm going to say thing that you often pick up. And sometimes it's, I'll wear my Detroit Tigers hat. I'm from, and maybe they're wearing a Cleveland Indians hat. And we start kind of, you know, playing back and forth about the rivalry or whatever. But anything that you can to kind of connect with them on a human level, it makes the hopefully human conversation you're going to have with them about politics more authentic and more real.
Have the people who identify as Democrat or Republican become smaller groups? Is the independent voter preeminent now?
I don't know the answer to that. We do talk about the greater polarization. And if you look at who Democrats are electing in their primaries and who Republicans are choosing in their primaries, they tend to be more ideological than they once were. It feels like the center is going away. You used to have a lot of overlap, you know. The left side of the Republican Party would overlap with the right side of the Democratic Party. And you'd even see that in Congress. There would be that big group in the middle that could and would cut deals and compromise and build consensus. You don't see that nearly as much anymore. Whether that means independents are growing, you should probably get the guys from 538 or or somewhere in here to talk about that. But you do feel the increased polarization.
Well, in a state like this, you see all these television commercials, you hear all these radio commercials, and you're thinking, who's left to convince?
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's a good point. There are people to convince because in this county where we're sitting right now, this is Cass County,
that's right? Imperial Cass to the rest of North Dakota.
So Trump carried it by just a whisker. Well, he got just over 50% here. I guess he carried it by a decent margin. But there were a lot of people who voted for neither Trump nor Hillary Clinton here. And then Heitkamp carried it,
So people know how to split a ticket.
So people know how to split a ticket, and that's where the battle is engaged, really.
We're visiting with Don Gagne from NPR News. He is a national political correspondent in North Dakota covering the reaction to the Senator Heitkamp decision to vote no on whether to confirm Judge Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. And Don, you mentioned near the beginning of this conversation that politically speaking, there's not a lot of reporters who are very used to coming to North Dakota. And normally you'd go to, Pennsylvania 15 times. And just your impression of North Dakota politically from when you first started out as a national political correspondent to now, if you could give that briefly.
It's always been one of those places that you think of it as a conservative place. And you think of the vast, rural spaces here. And I confess, you think of it as being a little bit remote because it's not a place that you just happen to pass through, right? When you're going on your way to someplace else, you have to choose to come here pretty much if you're, you know, especially when you're covering politics. You know, I go through Pennsylvania and Ohio all the time just on my way someplace else. And that doesn't happen with North Dakota. But, you know, even as I describe it that way, it's also one of those places, you know, not unlike Montana, that will elect a Democrat to statewide office. And that makes it very interesting. And it's obviously it's what makes it really, really, really interesting in this particular cycle when control of the Senate hangs in the balance. So it's not a place that you can, you know, have ready assumptions about as you might a place, you know, like Alabama or Idaho or, you know, or California or, you know, New York State when it comes to kind of statewide politics.
But this is a hyper-partisan tempest that we're in, reflected in the Kavanaugh nomination. Has this changed the Supreme Court or the way we look at the Supreme Court?
I think polls would tell us that the answer to that is yes. If we use the approval rating number, I don't know what they are off the top of my head, but the Supreme Court is one of those institutions that number has gone down as we've had these huge battles. Now, it's gone down in the past, I think most notably after the Bush v. Gore ruling in 2000. But we're in one of those moments now.
I mean, if there's such a partisan discussion around Brett Kavanaugh, mm-hmm. and you can just, I guess, project to the future if he gets on the court, there will be issues before him that will be looked at as highly partisan.
Yeah, absolutely. And every case will be, you know, held up as one that, gee, maybe he should recuse himself from this one. There will be people stepping forward. I mean, not every case, obviously, but a lot of cases. But the other thing is the reality is it's an individual justice who makes the decision as to whether or not they need to step aside in any given case.
But we've got this extraordinary event that happened last week when he testified mm-hmm. to the Senate Judiciary Committee and made statements that I don't think I've ever heard a judge make.
Yeah, no, I thought the same thing, you know, specific references to the Clintons, specific references to the Democrats. Now, his argument, I have not read the whole thing yet, but I understand he's got an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal kind of dialing it back a little bit and trying to put
say
what
that
he
I
did.
Can't that it can be fair that
but it's and I've heard Republicans talk about that, you know, he wasn't talking about specific issues, he was talking about the process of his nomination, so that shouldn't affect his ability to rule on any other issue. But those complaints and calls for him to step aside on this case or that case, they're not going to disappear. We can count on them being there as long as he's on the court.
Well, it's going to be a very interesting midterm election, and thank you for sharing some of your insights with us today, Doug.
I'm glad I could come by. Thank you guys for the work you do. And my first public radio job was at a member station, the station in Detroit, and I believe in the member station's mission, and I'm honored to be part of that and part of this.
Well, thanks for reminding us that we're in a member drive as well.
That's there we go.
Don Gagne is NPR national political correspondent. Coming up, we'll talk with our news director, Dave Thompson, about the headlines across North Dakota this past week, and Matt Olin will review another new movie. First, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. North Dakota Congressman Kevin Cramer says he's very optimistic a new farm bill will be voted on before the end of the year, likely in the lame duck session after the midterm election. Progress stalled as the House and Senate couldn't come to an agreement and a conference committee was appointed. Cramer says the four principal conferees, the chairman and ranking members of the House and Senate Ag Committees, have been meeting and will continue to work on it through October.
The nice thing about a conference committee is that all sides have to agree, which makes final passage rather easy. So they continue to debate it, discuss it, negotiate it. They keep us in the loop. I get regular updates from Chairman Conway I'm confident we can get something done well before the end of the year.
Kramer says if an agreement can't be reached by the lame duck session, then he could see Congress passing a one-year extension of the current farm bill.
Which in and of itself isn't the worst outcome. We have a pretty darn good farm bill from 2014. It's worked rather well. We'd like to improve on it, obviously. We'd like farmers to have a 5 years of certainty rather than, you know, one more growing season of certainty.
Kramer says if you can come up with a bill that can satisfy all four of the principal negotiators, there should be no problem getting it through. The North Dakota Catholic Conference is urging a no vote on Measure 3, the recreational marijuana initiative. Conference Executive Director Christopher Dodson says it's an issue concerning children, families, and the health of communities. Dodson says the measure sets no limits on the possession, growth, or sale of marijuana.
Most states that have legalized recreational marijuana, they allow like an ounce, couple ounces. There's no limits here. We can't risk our communities, our children, and their health by voting for Measure 3.
Dodson says there are questions on the measure that would have to be resolved by legislative action, and that takes a two-thirds vote by each chamber.
That's a hurdle. It's a hurdle, and we've seen it before. It was barely done with medical marijuana. So if there are problems with Measure 3, we can't just say, well, the legislature is going to take care of it.
And a refresh of North Dakota's branding. The state has been using the legendary brand for 15 years. The tweak? Legendary. Governor Burgum announced it in a video on the state government homepage.
To refresh North Dakota's brand for today's audiences, we're making a simple but powerful adjustment to our tagline.
Burgum says the refresh includes a new logo, new colors and photos, and more conversational language.
As we undertook this important brand refresh project, it was essential that our brand maintain its strong equity in our legendary roots, while giving us a cohesive way to connect with all of our audiences.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Well, this is Main Street on Prairie Public, and the sound of that old wire machine means that it's Friday, and it's time to talk with our news director, Dave Thompson, who stands by our microphone, or occasionally sits by it, I think, in our studio in Bismarck. Hello, Dave.
Hey, Doug, how's it going?
It's going great for me. I wasn't shoveling snow this morning.
No, you weren't, but I was. Even though I live in a condo, what I had to do is when I came to work at 4 o'clock in the morning and found out that we were not running regular programming, I knew exactly what had happened because it has happened before. Our satellite dish fills up with snow and we can't get like NPR programming. So I had to go out there with a little rake thing we have and you know, get the snow off the dish. And here it is, October 5th.
Yeah, it's a little early for that. Incidentally, I came across this video on the Forum News Service today. It's these four farmers in Tolna, North Dakota, taking off their shirts to make snow angels in the street in Tolna.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, it's snowing, apparently, and that's unusual.
It is unusual. But, and we've got some pretty decent-sized flakes.
Well, stop it. And, well, of course, you had to sweep off that dish so we could get NPR. And this
morning,
the big news on NPR and everywhere else was Heidi Heitkamp's decision to vote no against Supreme Court Associate Justice nominee Brett Kavanaugh.
There were lots of stories on NPR about it. And, of course, we have NPR reporters Don Gagne is in North Dakota and followed up on that story. So
and he led our show today.
He led our show. Yeah, and that's great. Wow, it's a spotlight on North Dakota because Heidi Heitkamp was one of those swing votes, and she swung to the no side.
Yeah, and we got to wonder why. Did she get into any detail?
Well, she said that after looking at everything that she really believed Dr. Ford's testimony, and she decided that – and she had some questions about Kavanaugh's temperament, and that's what she said why she became a no vote.
Yeah, I think that's been getting some traction lately because those people who were sort of on the fence about this he said, she said issue about sexual misconduct a long time ago, I think were probably struck by his temperament, his demeanor when he confronted the Senate committee,
right,
particularly the Democrats.
Right, but then you're hearing some pushback on the other side too. Kavanaugh supporters are saying he was right to be angry, and he was just expressing human emotions too.
Yeah, but the concern I think justice watchers have is that he's going to be a Supreme Court justice, and he's going to be deciding things that are highly politically polarized.
Right, and you can see the argument for both sides that if you have somebody like that who kind of played a partisan card, is that a good thing? But then again, you had the people who are supporting him saying these were just human emotions that kind of exploded at a hearing.
Well, meanwhile, this is a very important decision for Senator Heitkamp because she was on the fence about it. And mm-hmm. now this is a political issue between her and Kevin Cramer.
That's right. And, you know, a lot of people I've been talking to thought that Heidi was put in a no-win situation. Mm-hmm. And Kevin Cramer could, you know, basically he was an early supporter, yet he's not casting a vote. Senator Heitkamp had to cast a vote.
And, of course, this has disrupted our plans for a very big political debate between Heitkamp and Cramer.
It did. And it came down to just the last couple days when the Senate Majority Leader called for a vote on Friday in terms of that cloture, which is to stop debate. Senator Heitkamp said she had to be in Washington, D.C. Therefore, it postponed what was supposed to be tonight's debate. And getting a reschedule has been a bit of a challenge because, candidates' calendars fill in, and you're just trying to see if there's any day that works.
Well, I think if there's a debate that people are looking forward to hearing and seeing, it's this one.
It's that one.
All right.
Well. And I can tell you as just an aside, because I've just recently agreed to do this, there's a debate scheduled October 26th in Fargo at NDSU. It's being sponsored by the North Dakota Broadcasters Association. I have been chosen to be the moderator of that debate.
Okay. And that is with?
That is with Heitkamp and Cramer.
Great. All right. So one at least.
So there'll be one at least, for sure.
You posted a story just recently that the Catholic Conference in North Dakota is opposing Measure 1 and 3. Why?
It is opposing Measure Number 1 because they believe that it goes too far. They like the idea of ethics. They think ethics is a great thing. But they said that this may, because of the requirements that people who give to organizations may have to be named even if they give a dollar, they worry that people who are going to contribute to a church may be named even though, you know, maybe a little bit of the money might go toward working on an issue at the legislature. And they're afraid, the Catholic Conference and other churches are afraid that may cut down on some of the donations they may get that help, you know, the churches survive and thrive.
And, of course, the church also occasionally lobbies for things it favors.
That's correct, yes.
How about Measure Number 3?
Measure Number 3, according to the North Dakota Catholic Conference, which basically represents the two bishops in North Dakota, mm-hmm. it's a safety and a family issue because there are no limits on the amount of marijuana that you can have in possession or the amount of marijuana that you can grow. Children, they say, might be a little bit endangered on this, even though it is not legal for someone under the age of 21 to buy it. There's some concern about possession and possession in the home and people getting their hands on it.
Well, you should know that Rick Steves, a famous travel writer and broadcaster and public broadcasting personality, came to North Dakota. He stopped by our studio this morning to speak in favor of Measure Number 3.
He's
from Washington State, where recreational marijuana is legal, and he's been an advocate since that was in debate in Washington State many years ago. So, interesting.
Was the question asked of him, I'm just curious, if we know what Washington's limits on how much you can have in possession or how much you can grow.
I'm not sure about that, and we'll hear from him on Monday. I don't think we addressed that particular question, but
I'm just kind of curious. Yeah.
You know, how many bottles of booze can you own?
Oh, good point.
Okay. Here's an issue that you've been talking about, Dave, and I guess we're getting some answers now. More than 1,000 online retailers have registered to collect North Dakota sales taxes.
Right, and they had a deadline of October 1st, and there's a threshold. If you have to be an online retailer who has $100,000 or more worth of sales in North Dakota in a year for you to be required to submit online sales taxes. Well, the tax commissioner said that his office is now focused on the 1,000 largest retailers because he says about 250 of the largest online retailers have signed up in North Dakota, and they're looking to see if there's compliance from the other 750. Do they have sales that reach that $100,000 threshold in North Dakota?
Boy, that's like getting 1,000 new businesses in the state in a way.
Absolutely, and you're talking about potentially some pretty good money in terms of sales tax collections. That's going to help the budget out coming in the 1921 biennium. They've really conservatively estimated $25 million over 2 years for the 1921, but that can be adjusted upward or downward depending on how much collection is coming in now until like June 30th of next year, which is the end of the fiscal year.
Well, meanwhile, you've also been reporting this week that state revenue is recovering.
It is. We're seeing a real recovery in sales tax from the Bakken and Northwest region. Actually, all of Western North Dakota seems to be recovering. And we've talked about this, that the larger cities, the four largest cities, either are flat or are down a bit in sales tax collections. And part of that, especially in the Valley, is because the Canadian dollar is pretty strong right now. And then there's a real change in the retail landscape. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, we're hearing that some Canadians are reluctant to come south because of the way they feel they've been treated.
Oh, that's true, too. And one thing that people in Grand Forks have told me is that one of the things that really hurt Grand Forks is when the Macy's store closed.
Ah.
So there were a lot of people coming across the border to shop at Macy's.
Well, meanwhile, as we talk about new strains of revenue, like from online retailers and the state revenue looking a little bit better than it had, we have requests from public employees that they get raises.
Right. And we've heard the governor say it's time to give them raises, but nothing's been in a concrete proposal. Now there is. There's the State Employee Compensation Commission that met, and they decided to recommend 2% for each year of the biennium, plus 1% in the first year to try to eliminate some of the compression problems.
And how about health insurance?
Health insurance, they also took a position on no change in the current plan. And there was some talk about maybe having state employees pay part of their health insurance premiums. And the committee voted, no, let's keep the health insurance premiums and the health insurance benefit the same way, where they're not paying out of pocket. One reason, they said, it helps attract new workers to state government.
Okay. Well, this week started with a rather interesting, unusual story, and that was when North Dakota Commerce Commissioner Jay Shuler resigned because he'd sent out something that was determined to be an unacceptable email.
It was. It was pretty much kind of in favor of Judge Kavanaugh.
Yeah, that's where we started this discussion.
That's where we started this discussion. And if you looked at the email, it was supporting him. It was what people had the problem with is that he used his state email.
Yes.
And so he met with the governor and decided to resign. He is unapologetic, as he should be. He has said that was the way he felt, but he said, I should not have used state email, and I should have realized that in sending it to my department. Commerce is a fairly sizable department in North Dakota, and you may have a lot of people with different political opinions.
Well, do we have any sense of how that meeting with Governor Burgum went?
Not anything more. The governor's office has said that the governor did not fire him.
Okay. So he basically submitted his resignation, said, I'm out of here because I think I should be, or because I'm fed up.
I think he should be. All indications were is that the Governor Burgum was really liking what Jay Shuler was doing at Commerce.
All right. Well, we check in with our news director every week. It's always illuminating to talk with you, Dave.
Well, thank you.
Well, this is that part of the show that we're going to remind you that we are in a membership week here at Prairie Public, and Ashley Thornburg and I are keen on getting these phones to ring.
This is the first day of our fall member drive, and the number to call to support the programming that you love is 1-800-359-4145. You can click and join at prairiepublic.org, or you can send a text message that is just the word support to the number 484848. You'll get a little link back and fill that out, and you're all set. It sounds so simple. It is so simple. It is a very important revenue stream here. We use that to pay for the programming. It's an expensive product to put out there.
And it's a reminder, as we had Don Gagne at the top of the show and we just talked with our own Dave Thompson, that news and information is one of the vital services that we provide because our listeners who become members make that possible. So membership is an important investment in what you're listening to here. The quality that it can become is in your hands. So I encourage you to pick up that phone. Give us a call at 800 359-4145 or go online to prairiepublic.org. Ashley Thornburg and I, you know, we have a thrilling day occasionally. Friday today was a thrilling day. We had Rick Steves in here. We had Don Gagne in here. We had other people.
We had
people.
Breaking news during Morning Edition.
Yeah, the big vote. Senator Heidi Heitkamp is the talk of the nation because of her decision. And, of course, lots of attention is focused on North Dakota because of the very tight and important political race between Heidi Heitkamp and Kevin Cramer. So this is an important service that you are supporting.
And now is not the time to just sit back and think, well, it's always been here. It's just always going to be here. We had a big budget cut because of the state. They had a lot of agencies across the state cutting budgets, and we are due again for another belt tightening. At the same time, Doug, that you just mentioned, people like NPR national political correspondent Don Gagne coming to town. PBS NewsHour's Judy Woodruff is in the state because North Dakota is not flyover country anymore. North Dakota has an important voice in the national arena. And at the same time, so you're coupling more news, more important, more just sources of information, and at the same time, budget cuts. We need the membership support to help us to continue to do that job.
Yeah, help us pay it forward, if you will. You know, more than 40% of our budget comes from members like you. And if you are a member, thank you. If you are a member, maybe consider becoming a sustaining member. That makes the paperwork a little bit easier, and it also saves a little bit of money because of the paperwork not being there. If you are a member, you might want to raise your membership. Ashley just made a case for that because we need more support from members to make up for less support elsewhere. So this is, you know, one of those few times we come to you during the year and remind you that we love listeners, but members make everything possible. They make listening possible. So if you're a listener, become a member. Give us a call at 800-359-4145 or go online to prairiepublic.org. It's time to go to the movies with Matt O'Lean. And Matt, this week you went to a movie whose title is pretty much the story.
Yes.
The House with a Clock in Its Walls.
Based on a popular novel directed by Eli Roth. Now, that's a surprise. Eli Roth is a horror director, and he has slipped into kind of like tween Goosebumps territory here with kind of a children's movie based on this, as you say, this 10-year-old child who goes to live with his uncle Jonathan, played by Jack Black, because his parents have died in an accident. And he's an eccentric uncle, to say the least. He lives in a strange house in Michigan, takes place 1955. He's got a neighbor, very strange lady, played by Kate Blanchett, double Oscar winner. Interesting to see her in a film like this, but she has dabbled in kids' movies, you know, Cinderella and things like that, despite having two Oscars on her mantelpiece. You know, it's a solid film, I would say well produced. It's got some frights and scares in there, but it never quite gets that fifth gear going into what I think it should be, which is kind of half comedy, half spooks for the kids. And despite a $27 million opening weekend, I'm not sure who this film is for, because I can tell you my 10-year-old Doug is too scared to go to the movie. And my 17-year-old son, the horse has left the barn, he doesn't want to see it. Boy, that sure narrows your audience. And it's not quite for adults either, despite the presence of Jack Black and Kate Blanchett. But some of the effects are good. Kind of that period setting of the 50s works pretty good. It's a short film. So I would give it a tentative. It's okay. But I didn't think Jack Black was terribly funny in it, too. And I'm not sure what that's about, Doug. You expect really raucous laughs from him. And he seems restrained in the role, despite playing this warlock, this eccentric parlor magician, as he refers to himself as. Blanchett actually fares better. Kyle MacLachlan's in the film as a warlock as well. But I kept wanting Jack Black to be a little funnier and for them to let him go and kind of unleash him, and it never quite happens in the film. So an extremely tentative yes, but you could certainly miss this one.
Now, you've said a few things that have really intrigued me here, mm-hmm. because The House with a Clock in Its Walls is described as a comedy,
yeah.
family, fantasy. Okay. You're saying that the family, as you would describe it, is maybe 5 or 6 years
yeah.
in breadth, if you will.
12 to 15, maybe.
The people who make these movies, especially movies that make, you know, 25, 27 million bucks their first weekend, they're applying some metrics to this. This isn't just art to them.
Right.
They're marketers. So what do they know that we don't know?
Well, it's based on a popular novel, and I think they assumed – and like I said, it's not a disaster. It's not like it's completely tanking like some of these tween films have done in recent years that don't quite understand what their audience is. So I'm not here to trash it or to say it's an awful film or it's underperformed. But again, it was released in a weird time of September. It's not quite Oscar season. It's not quite kids movie season either. So but of course they want it probably closer to Halloween. Yet it didn't quite come out in October. It was out September 21st. So again, I kind of questioned the marketing strategy there of when to release it. I would have maybe released it a little closer to the Goosebumps Part 2 film, which is coming in a couple weeks, which again, my daughter is afraid to go see. But she is a little bit of a fraidy cat with some of these things, I must say, which is fine. Kids are different. You have to understand your child and not take them to films that are going to haunt them. But again, I might have released it closer to October, although they might not have wanted to compete with the Goosebumps 2 movie. I'm not sure. And well, Jack Black has a history with the first Goosebumps movie.
Well, what I was getting at with my question was it looks like they're going to make money with this
movie. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm sure of that. And I doubt that I shouldn't say I don't know what Black and Blanchett's salary were for this film. But like I said, if you want to take maybe an 11 or 12-year-old to this, I think it would probably work for them okay. It's funny in parts, good period detail. You know, Black and Blanchett are real movie stars, both of them, but it just didn't quite have that great fantasy feel I was looking for. And that is kind of what the reviews are saying too. It's almost but not quite there. That's the best way I can say it.
What period is this set in?
1955.
Oh, right. Well,
yes.
I kind of know that one.
There you go.
Reason right there for me.
Yeah.
The House with a Clock in Its Walls, a tepid yes from Matt.
By the way, the house is gigantic. I mean, you look at it from the outside and you get inside and there's just – the rooms never end. So it's – I think the interior is bigger than what the exterior looks like
in the
film.
Sounds like the Winchester Mansion or something. Okay. Well, here is my Oscar trivia question. And, of course, you sort of revealed it in your discussion of the movie because you identified the one member of the cast who has won Academy Awards, and that's Cate Blanchett.
Yes.
So let's go the extra step here. Which movies, what year?
The Aviator, 2004, as Katharine Hepburn. Blue Jasmine, 2013. Do you want me to give you her other five nominations? I sure can.
Well, go right
Elizabeth,
ahead.
1998. Notes on a Scandal, 2006. I'm Not There, 2007. Elizabeth, The Golden Age, 2007. And Carol, 2015.
All right. I'd like to hear that vault close one of these days, but we have to say goodbye. Thank you, Matt Olien.
Hi, I'm Tom Ezern. I'd like to invite you to pick up my latest book, Pacing Dakota, for your $15 a month investment in Prairie Public. This book, Pacing Dakota, it's been a joy to me to travel around North Dakota, meeting the people who have been listening to Plains Folk on Prairie Public for years, and we've never laid eyes on one another, but now we have. Call 800-359-4145. Or go to prairiepublic.org or text the word support to this number, 484848, and click on the link. Your support helps make programs like Main Street possible, not to mention the excellent news coverage Prairie Public delivers for the state of North Dakota. I hope you'll pick up the book, Pacing Dakota, and catch my Plains Folk essay every week on Main Street, and be generous in your support of Prairie Public this year and every year. Thank you.
This is Dakota Datebook for October 5th. Many towns in North Dakota are named for someone, like the city of Regan. J. Austin Regan was an early businessman and mover and shaker in North Dakota. He was born in 1870 in Ontario and grew up in Missouri. He came to Carrington, North Dakota when he was 21 and worked for an implement dealer for 2 years before moving to Pheasanton, where he established a machinery business with a partner. He also formed an elevator business in 1896. Regan became sole owner of the implement dealership, but in 1899 the store burned, along with others, in a great fire in 1899. In addition to his business dealings, Regan was the Pheasanton postmaster for 10 years. Regan also had his hand in politics. He chaired the Wells County Republican Central Committee, was a state senator, and served as president pro tem of the Senate in the 1907 session. He married a Pheasanton school teacher, and they had one son. Regan was an agent of the Dakota Land and Townsite Company, which platted the town of Regan in 1911. Regan also had a hand in platting other towns along the rail line, like McCluskey, Turtle Lake, and Mercer. The first building in Regan was an ice house intended to serve a creamery that local farmers hoped to build, but the creamery never materialized. A church was built next, using wood from Wilton, North Dakota. There's some discrepancy as to when the post office was established, but this date in 1911 has been given, though its operation probably didn't start until early 1912. Lillian Onge was the first postmaster. She commuted 3 miles in a buggy from a farm to town until finally obtaining living quarters in Regan. Stores, banks, and other businesses followed, and Regan's population peaked with 200 residents in 1920. Today, there are about 40 or 50 people. As for J. Austin Regan, he's remembered for his business acumen and, of course, the town that bears his name. He died in 1924 at the age of 53. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
The president's evangelical supporters are working hard to get out the vote this November, but concerns about moral issues have inspired believers on the left to head to the polls as well.
That's one of the reasons I'm passionate about voting, is because I want to help be part of that, to say, you know, I believe in Jesus Christ and I believe, you know, in liberal progressive values.
Plus the latest on all the Kavanaugh news. That's on the next morning edition from NPR News.
That's tomorrow morning right here on Prairie Public.
Well, as we've been mentioning today, we do have a membership drive underway because it's important to keep this operation going, and members make us possible. We've got some premiums that we can offer to people who join up today. For example, on Friday, we're offering $5 Friday. We're discounting the new Prairie Public winter hat for $5 a month. It'll be $15 a month after Friday. The Prairie Public socks, $5 a month. $10 after today. So give us a call, 800-359-4145, online at prairiepublic.org. On Monday, we're going to visit with Adam Arvidsson, author of Wild and Rare, a book about Minnesota's endangered species. And we'll also, of course, as we mentioned, public broadcasting personality Rick Steves. He stopped by our studio to explain why he supports initiated measure number 3 in North Dakota for recreational marijuana. And we hope you'll join us for Main Street Weekend, Sunday morning at 10 Central. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.